Hello and welcome to Hysteria. I'm Erin Ryan.
And I'm Alyssa Mastromonaco.
Alyssa, Ted Cruz was in the news over the past week for being an idiot, trying to go on a vacation to Cancun as people in his state, people who elected him, people who were ostensibly paying his salary, freezed and had to boil their water in order to be able to drink it. So my question for you this week is, what vacation destination would you risk it all for?
Well, I would risk it, I think I would want to go to Kauai Cliffs, New Zealand, which was where we were supposed to go on our honeymoon, but my cat Shrummy got sick, and when you marry the best person ever, they say, we can't leave the sick cat, we have to stay behind. And also now, Jacinda Ardern, who wouldn't want to go to New Zealand?
I know, I just want to be close to her. I just want to be close to Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern.
You even kind of look like her.
Oh, that's so nice.
You're so lucky.
So my place that I would get caught going to while my state suffered, I would be like, okay, you know what? My career, my reputation, almost worth it. There is a preserve in Rwanda for the lowland gorillas that Diane Fossey used to work out of. And it's currently got, you know, all these lowland gorillas that live there, and they only allow a limited number of people to visit every year. And it has been the place that's been, like, I'll never be able to afford to go there. But if I could, I would risk a lot of people getting mad at me in order to go and see the lowland gorillas in an environmentally responsible way.
So wait, what you're saying is you wouldn't take Coach to Cancun to risk your career.
No! Coach to Cancun, like, come on. That's not only an asshole thing, it's a tacky asshole thing.
Do you think he was going to go to Senior Frogs, though?
He was going to drink an entire glass boot of something. Nobody who's that shitty at their job deserves to take a vacation.
Agree.
On this week's episode, Dr. Heather Irabunda, Riri Cheney, and Julissa Arce join us to tackle the following questions. Who deserves to be toasted and roasted in the news this week? Then we have our most meta episode ever for a podcast called Hysteria and talk about our bodies and healthcare. How is TikTok helping demystify going to the gynecologist? How many people have been told that their pain is all in their head? And why does it sometimes feel like we each need a full-time assistant to help us advocate for ourselves? All this and more right now. Okay, so we have a ton of show to get to today. This is the show where we're talking about, like, medical stories and all that stuff. So I think we're going to do a quick version of news so we can get right to the meat of the show, if you will. Let's just do a couple toasts and roasts.
Yeah.
Okay. So speaking of Texas, I think we have a toast to offer in addition to the roast of Ted Cruz. And that is to AOC and Beto O'Rourke and others who have contributed to raising millions. I think it was $5
million. $5 million. They made 784,000 calls to seniors to check in on them.
Yeah, they're actually doing work that Ted Cruz did not do. They've, but the, you know, Texas had a historically large and power outage that anybody who had anything to do with the grid could have seen coming. And now the people who are supposed to just live in Texas and not have to worry about their power have to worry about all these things. It was a real fuck up of unfettered capitalism. And it's really good to see people like O'Rourke and AOC coming in there to help try to bridge the gap between what the government was supposed to do and what the government actually did. So that's a good toast. Alyssa, do you want to toast our favorite Biden nominee?
Deb Haaland. To be Secretary of the Interior, knock wood, barring anything crazy. I mean, Erin, she came out for her confirmation hearing just fucking like ready to go. She was calm. She was smooth. Every time the Republicans tried to fuck with her, she was just like unflappable. She spoke in a voice that one of my friends and I called Zanny voice. It's like as if you've taken a Xanax because nothing is going to get your blood pressure up. And she just knew she was so She was so impressive and great, and we are so excited for her.
Mm-hmm. And it's super exciting also for members of the Indigenous community, yeah, because she will become the first Native American Interior Secretary. The Department of the Interior also contains the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and it is absurd that they never once had a Native American in charge of the Bureau of Indian Affairs in the history of the U.S. So Deb Haaland, one of New Mexico's finest. We love New Mexico here.
Because it's one of the finest states.
One of America's best states. And she's going to do such great, she's going to be such a great head of that department. And, you know, both symbolically and just as an individual who just knows her shit. So I'm so excited. I have a sweatshirt with Deb Haaland's face on the front of it.
What?
Yeah. I'll show it to you. I'll send you a picture after we are done recording.
Okay, that's very good.
It's when I wear it around my neighborhood, which is, I got to say, it's a blue neighborhood within a blue city. I get some thumbs ups for my Deb Haaland sweatshirt.
That's amazing.
Yeah, love Deb Haaland around here. Let's do a quick roast. You know, sometimes when we roast people that were at one point the subjects of toasts, because it's very important to have an adult relationship with the government that you have hired to
correct
govern you, which means that sometimes they're going to do things that make you happy, and sometimes they're going to do things that make you mad. Alyssa, you're closer to this one than I am, so why don't I'll let you take the reins.
Governor Andrew Cuomo, we must roast you. Anyone who's sort of seen bits and pieces of this in the news, he and his administration have had an issue with the reporting of deaths of people who were in nursing homes and were not counting people who left nursing homes to be hospitalized and then passed in a hospital. Now, there's a lot going back and forth. And look, he said, and his staff says, that the reason they underreported that number back in August or September was because the Trump administration was trying to be punitive. They wanted to investigate them. They wanted to take resources away from New York State. Here's the thing. I get all that. But then he threatened, bullied, like verbally attacked members of the New York Assembly and told them to like get out and put positive statements. And if they didn't, he was going to destroy them. And here's what we've learned, Erin. I just think as a rule, don't say things like, I will destroy you to people. It never ends well. People don't abide or appreciate that sort of philosophy. So just like, look, people have always thought of Cuomo as a bully. His handling of the COVID crisis sort of redeemed him in certain ways in people's eyes. And then just to hear this, you're like, nope, he was always the same.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I will destroy you is a bad thing to say if you're a public-facing person, period.
Just don't.
I believe that I will destroy you has just often ends up destroying you, the one who said it, if anybody ever finds out about it. The nursing home statistical like cloak and daggering that Cuomo did is pretty gross. Right. But I also want to add that like he really has done basically jack shit to help the restaurant and the food service industry in New York. My friend Haley, my best friend who I grew up with from when we were kids, works in food service in New York, and she's been trying to, you know, people who work in the industry have been trying to raise their plight to his attention, and he just seems like extremely indifferent to it. And I just think, you know, I hope that he has some sort of political accountability for this, because some of the stuff he did made him look like he was doing good shit. And ultimately it seems like a lot of it was window dressing, and that is not what people need. People need actual governance instead of just a guy who gets on TV and plays a governor every day.
And also, everybody knows that when you are facing a crisis, get out in front of it. If you're threatening people, guess what? It's coming out. And so instead, imagine if they had said shortly after Election Day, this is what we did. Here's why we did it. You don't agree with us. We understand. We had to make a judgment call. Here are the real numbers. And, you know, get on with it. Mm-hmm. Trying to bury it never works and actually makes you seem like you didn't just hide it because of Trump. It makes it look like you're just fucking trying to hide it. Mm-hmm. And so do better.
Yeah, do better and spend less energy if you're the governor of New York having a cat fight with the mayor of New York City. I'm so fucking over. I don't even live there anymore. And I am so over the de Blasio Cuomo slap fight. Boys, grow the fuck up.
No one's going to be president. Stop dreaming that big dream.
Neither of you are going to be president. No. I will work to make sure neither of you become president. And I'm in your party. Fucking govern. Gosh. Okay. I'm sure we'll be talking more about all of the people that we toasted and roasted this week. But for now, let's transition to the medical part of the show. We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we are going to talk to Dr. Heather Irabunda, who is an amazing OBGYN and advocate based out of New York City, who can answer some of our questions about healthcare. And welcome back. Today, we are so excited to welcome Dr. Heather Irabunda. She's a board-certified OBGYN based out of New York City and a women's health advocate. If you're not already following her on Instagram and TikTok, run, don't walk to that follow button. She is leading the charge in making women's health accessible, relatable, and dare I say, fun. Welcome, Dr. Heather Irabunda.
Hi, ladies. How are you?
Hello.
Hello. We're doing good.
Good.
We're really excited to talk to you today. So one thing that you've brought a lot of attention to is the Black maternal health crisis in the U.S. Black moms in the U.S. are 3 to 4 times more likely to die from pregnancy-related deaths than white moms, and Black moms in New York City are 8 to 12 more times more likely. Those are horrible statistics. So, doctor, what's going on, and why isn't this very alarming stat front page news?
Well, this stat actually has been steadily getting worse over the last almost 30 years. So since 1990, the overall mortality rate for pregnant women of all races has gone up in America. But most notably, the disparity between that mortality rate, the mortality rate of white women versus Black women, has distanced itself remarkably. So as you mentioned, 3 to 4 times, Black women are 3 to 4 times more likely to die from a pregnancy-related death than white women. And here where I am in New York City, it's 8 to 12 times more likely, which is crazy. And so there's a lot of different things that are being thought of as to why this is happening. One of the biggest things we think is causing this is systemic issues, like so systemic racism and implicit bias in medicine. Because really what's interesting is that the marker for Black maternal mortality or maternal mortality in general really tells you about a larger issue with health access for all individuals, no matter the gender, the race, and all of that. So that's why it's actually really like very alarming, because it tells you the status of everyone's health in a community.
Mm-hmm. So doctor, all these issues are perpetuated by a system of oppression and a healthcare system that was not created to help everyone.
Right.
How has your experience with racism in the medical field influenced your journey as a doctor and your philosophy on care? What sort of prejudices within the medical field are you noticing as the most prevalent?
Well, for me, I grew up in the Bronx. I grew up in New York City. So I work in the Bronx. I've lived in the Bronx. I now live in Queens, which I'm kind of cheating on the Bronx for. But neither here nor there. But the thing for me is like growing up, right? So my parents, like my mom was in school. My dad didn't have like a high paying job when I was really young. And so I went to free clinics to get my immunizations and to get all that stuff. And what I remember the most is that we used to go to different clinics all the time, right? So I didn't have a consistent pediatrician, which some of my colleagues, when I went to other schools, like when I went to high school, when I went to college, they were like, oh yeah, I've known my pediatrician since I was a baby. And that wasn't the same for me. And a lot of my patients experience the same things. In addition to that, there's like access to care. So if you're low income, underinsured, you don't have a job that has either good insurance or you don't have insurance, then it's harder for you to get into the doctor for preventative care. And so what happens is that when you go into pregnancy as a pregnant mom, you're in like a worse state of health than if you were someone who was consistently going to the doctor, getting annual physicals, and not just going when things are in extremis. So I see kind of the structural issues with that. And it does affect communities of color more because of redlining. Like, so housing, I know a lot of people are talking about housing discrimination and housing differences. That actually affects your health care because it affects the amount of funding your local hospital gets, your local clinics get. So all of that is wrapped up into all of it. So that's a big thing that I've seen. And then in terms of implicit bias, I mean, unfortunately, in my training and even as someone who's now, you know, a full-fledged doc, I've seen and I've heard my colleagues talk about patients in some disparaging ways, like, oh, they don't know what's good for them. We know what's good for them. Oh, she's complaining of pain. I don't think she's in as much pain. So those are the things that you hear, and that's what's the most concerning, because you're not sure if they're taking, if my colleagues are taking these patients' complaints or issues with as much vigor as they should be, as they're not paying as much attention to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and kind of piggybacking on that, the way that the system sort of like infantilizes and disempowers patients in some cases, I think contributes to a distrust. But then there's also bigger issues, obviously, that contribute in some communities to a general distrust of the medical field.
Yes.
So how do you rebuild that distrust for Black and brown people who maybe are less inclined to even try to go to the doctor because of the way they were treated?
And you are so right when you say that, because the infantilization, the distrust, it's so deep in our communities. And so one big thing is making sure that the healthcare community reflects the people that they work for. So increasing the number of Black nurses, Black doctors, Black, people who just work in the medical care facilities, and even more importantly, people from the community trying to find that. And I know it's hard because, as a lot of us know, only 2% of doctors in the United States are Black women. So there are not many of us out there. So it's hard, but we need to look towards the next generation and start increasing the numbers of people who go into these fields. In addition, looking at culturally competent care. So requiring that people who work in medicine really get an understanding of the communities that they're working in. And it's hard. People are burnt out. We have to learn a lot. We have to know a lot to do our jobs. But what's really important is that if you look at these outcomes and see that we're having such poor outcomes compared to other industrialized nations, we need to do something different, and we need to do it now. So I do think that, you know, making sure that we are instituting initiatives to talk about culturally competent care, actually having a lot of these discussions happen with people of color, because a lot of times the implicit bias training, culturally competent care, doesn't come from someone of color. So then you're like, well, is it really working? Is it really, like, are we really getting anywhere with this?
Mm-hmm. Let's pivot a little bit to social media, because you've brought so much attention to women's health in a very tangible way via Instagram and your TikTok. Usually, women's health is such a taboo topic. You see a tampon commercial or a birth control commercial advertising their products, but you never really hear what they're supposed to do, what they're supposed to be for.
Right.
So you're doing yeoman's work to demystify these questions and issues. What is the most common question you get from women when it comes to their reproductive health?
Well, a big question that I get is, how is it supposed to smell? Like, I'm not sure if what I'm smelling is what's supposed to, is how things supposed to smell. And so that's actually, yeah, that's probably one of the number one questions. And usually the first thing I ask people is like, does it smell bad or does it smell different? Because those are two different, those are two different things, because there's like a very big difference between bad and different. And that's why some people get overtreated for different issues like vaginitis, which is like inflammation of the vagina, which could be due to not just infectious things, but just like you may have used a soap that wasn't too good and your body didn't like it, or you had a partner who used a soap that wasn't too good and your body didn't like it. So, you know, it's just, it's really getting into the weeds and figuring out what exactly, you know, what's going on and having those conversations. And I think that with my social media, I'm really trying to make it easy for people to be like, hey, your doctor either has experienced it or seen it a million times. This is what we listen to. This is what we're trained to do. And like, we're also normal people. So you can talk to us like normal people and we're not going to judge you or freak out.
That is really nice to hear from an OBGYN. What is your favorite part of being an OBGYN?
I think for me, it's empowering vagina owners, because growing up, I grew up in like a pretty conservative household. I'm first generation. So my dad's African and my mom's from Jamaica and she's like super old school. And so, I mean, literally I was taught nothing about this. I went to Catholic all girls high school also, which didn't, which like compounded on the issue. So I felt like I didn't know anything. And like all of the information I was getting was either from like 17 magazine or some comparable magazine, or like the other girls in Catholic school, which let me tell you, did not know that much. And so, and so I like that I'm able to see people and be like, okay, sit down, let me tell you about what's going on, and be like, I totally didn't know this either. Like, fun fact, I didn't know how to track my period until medical school. I'm not even kidding.
What?
Maybe I was a little behind in the eight ball, but I did not know. I was like, first day, last day, I don't know. It comes every month, and if it doesn't come, I freak out because maybe I'm pregnant. Like, I know nothing else. So I'm glad that I'm able to share what I've learned to other people about how those parts work and what's going on. And I'm like, isn't it really cool? Because I think it is.
Mm-hmm. I bet that experience has made you feel like your experience of growing up not knowing stuff is actually kind of normal. And like a lot of people yes. are just learning about themselves as they get older. And it's good to have people like you who can help shepherd them along the path. Do you think it's moving in a positive direction? Are you seeing more people of color and more people of culturally diverse backgrounds engaging in the field of OBGYN?
I actually do. I do think it's moving way more forward, because it used to actually be a male-dominated field. Like, OBGYNs used to be guys, like all men. And then it's moved into that direction. And now we're more of a female-driven field, which you would expect so, because most people who are female have vaginas, right? So that's why it's super exciting that we're moving in that direction. And it's one of the most diverse subspecialties in medicine. So it's super exciting. I'm super happy that it's moving this direction, because we need it so badly.
Definitely. And then also to just put a button on this conversation, there's a bill in Congress right now called the Black Maternal Health Momnibus that addresses the crisis in Black maternal health and directs the Department of Health and Human Services and other agencies to address maternal health outcomes among minority populations. And we need it to pass.
We do. We do.
So if you're listening, call your congressperson. Let them know you want them to support the bill. That number is 202-224-3121. And you can tell him Dr. Heather Irrabunda sent you. Maybe.
Definitely. Yeah, totally. I'll take the hit for that one.
Wait, Heather, are you taking new patients?
I am taking new patients.
Oh, I'm coming to see you. No question. I just talked for 45 minutes about my trauma with my recent gyno. And so I am coming to see you.
I feel like so many people, I'm like, I love being like the person who listens. I'm like, let me hear the traumas. Cause like, I feel like I hear so much. That's the reason why I feel so passionate. That's why I started my social media, because everybody has a story. I have a really terrible story. I was in the military, and my first pap in the military, they basically like lined us up And I was on my period. I was like, can I even do this now? I was, you know, like 23 or something like that. And they were like, yeah, no problem. And they were like, everybody go in the room, pants off, whatever, sit on the bed. And I'm like, I'm literally bleeding on myself. They were like, you have to take everything off. And I like bled all over the place. And the guy was like, I'm sure it's not that bad. It was that bad. And then he was like, oh, it was that bad. And I just sat in a pool of my own period blood for like an hour and a half.
It's about right.
Oh my gosh.
That's why I went into OBGYN. Because after that experience, it was like, no one should ever have to experience this.
Yeah.
No, I feel like a new person now that I'm going to come see you.
Totally. Come to the BX. That's where I am.
Oh, no problem. I'll be there.
Alyssa's taking notes. She's going to
go. No, you can tell the whole time I've been taking notes. I was like, okay, I have solved my problem.
There you go.
Thank you so much, Dr. Heather Irrabunda. Thank you for all the work you do. And we have to take a quick break.
Thank you, guys.
The country feels like it's falling apart right before our eyes, and the people inside it are being silenced.
So we're going to East 26th Street and Nicolette Avenue, which is where Alex Preti was executed by ICE and Border Patrol.
That is not a headline. That is a human life, and it is all happening right now.
Do you worry about your own safety being involved in all this?
Yes, but it doesn't really feel like there's another option, you know?
And of course they use a 5-year-old child as bait. And of course they're doing all these horrible, bad things because they don't know what they're doing. They've been told that they're going to get rid of the worst, then they have absolute immunity. And they've been told that nothing they do will they ever be held accountable for.
On my show, Runaway Country, we go where the headlines hit home, from communities under threat to the people fighting to be heard. New episodes of Runaway Country drop every Thursday. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or watch on YouTube.
Save big on everything when you shop at Menards. Give your walls the most advanced protection with Pittsburgh's Paramount Interior Paint and Primer in 1. It's scuff, scrub, and wear resistant, while also blocking stains and delivering true one coat coverage. Choose from thousands of color options and refresh your space for spring. View our entire selection of paint and accessories today on Menards.com. Plus, check out the weekly flyer to find great deals happening this week.
Save big money at Menards.
Welcome back. This is the part of the show where Alyssa and I are joined by other people who make us feel slightly less lonely. Not that we're lonely together. It's just, you know, the more the merrier in hysteria land. I don't want to spend too much time going back and forth about small talk and stuff because I kid you not, I have like 20 pages of notes for this show. So without further ado, I'm going to bring in the other two panelists today. First off, she is a writer of things that you will, quote, know about in 4 years. And a general gal about town. Please welcome Riri Cheney.
Hi, guys. Nice to, you know, New Year's. Is this my first time this year? I don't know. I don't know what time
been here
is.
Before, have but it was I? A sad one.
Oh, yes. Never mind. Happy Black History Month, everyone. We're doing it.
You were like, you came on a sad one and you were like, it's not going to be sad the next
time. Yeah, that's true. I really was like, we're going to be, yeah, and of course what we're about to talk about, light as shit. But we're really trying, guys.
But it's not about the news, really. I mean, it's about a kind of omnipresent pall over the lives of many people.
Oh, I love a Paul.
And second up, welcoming her as an official part of the Hysteria team for the first time. You've heard her a bunch, though, so you guys know and love her already. She is an author of 2 books plus a new book that will also have a title, according to her. Please welcome Julissa Arce.
Thank you. I'm so excited. I feel like You guys have made an honest woman out of me. Finally.
Yeah, we can go out in public now and we don't have to worry about running into somebody.
Yeah, we can like hold hands in public. Well, you know, after COVID.
That's true. From now we can just like socially distant. I wonder if socially distant hanging like elicits the same scandalous response among people that seeing people holding hands would have before COVID. Like before COVID, you see two people like holding hands or smooching and you're like, ooh, mm-hmm. What's going on there? I didn't know about this coupling. But now you see them in a socially distant hang. It's like, ooh, a dog walk. What are they up to?
Also, especially out here, because like so many people's hangs involve like ventures into nature. Aaron's culture, not mine. And so to the idea that someone like drove there, like went to a location is like, oh, y'all smashing? That's fun. Like, okay.
It's like the only thing that's acceptable in public are these like Victorian style dates
with walkabouts,
like a 6-foot chaperone. Mm-hmm. Okay. So this week's topic, we asked you all, our listeners, to submit stories that fit in with what we were about to talk about. And I don't know, Alyssa knows how many emails we got about this. How many would you estimate we got?
I mean, like a lot, like more than a screen full.
Like hundreds. I think we got like two or three screens full of emails from listeners. And they were all like multi-paragraph stories that pertain to this topic. So yeah, we have a lot to talk about. So first, I want to kind of preface this conversation about the medical field and our interactions with the American healthcare system as patients. I want to preface it by saying my big takeaway from reading every single one of the emails, I literally read everyone. I think that the big takeaway, just to start, is that I don't think that we individually think that doctors are bad people. No. And I also don't think that hearing that people had a bad time at the doctor should discourage anybody from seeking help from a medical condition. That's the opposite of what should happen. I think the biggest takeaway is that big picture, the fact that so many women have a medical horror story indicates how urgently the system needs to change. It feels like the system is the villain here, not individual doctors and nurses that are working their asses off that have nothing to do with cases that people have told us about. So I'm hoping that this conversation normalizes how important it is for us to advocate for ourselves within this really fucked up system. And I hope it normalizes going up the chain for answers. And I hope it normalizes demanding systemic change so that, you know, everybody can be better off, healthcare professionals, patients, everybody. And I hope at the very least this feels cathartic. So with that being said, let's get started. Julissa, I want to start with you since it's your first official show as an official member of the official squad.
I love that.
How old were you when you realized that doctors aren't infallible and that there are good and bad doctors, and what happened?
So I think I knew this when I was a child, like going to the doctor in Mexico, and because I had the back of an earring get stuck in my ear, like inside my ear. And so I had to have surgery to have it removed. And the doctor was intoxicated. And so then my mom obviously didn't let them like operate on me, right? But I was little, but I distinctly remember like my mom being frantic about not, you know, like running in there being like, don't you dare like touch her because the doctor wasn't okay. So I was very little when I realized that there are people who like make mistakes and have lives. But that was a pretty traumatic experience just being like, you know, already in the like little table. It wasn't like a huge like operation, right? Because all they had to do was like slip my little ear open and like get the little thing out, which by the way, I don't think they ever did take out. It's like there, like I can feel it in my ear. So,
oh my gosh.
So it's there.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. But I was pretty young when I realized it.
Mm-hmm. Your point about them being people is really important because like any profession that's that geographically spread out and that involves that many human beings is like, yeah, human beings are human beings. You know, there are good ones and bad ones. But I think you know, the medical field is one of those things that you trust them so entirely. And a lot of times you go there in a place of fear. And so all it takes is one bad experience or one experience where you feel like you weren't treated well to really leave a lasting impression. Riri, how old were you when you realized that doctors weren't infallible?
I think I must have been a little older. I was really lucky in that. One, I grew up knowing a lot of doctors that look like me. So that kind of engendered an amount of trust. Like, that's Ella's dad. That's, you know, my sister's mother is a doctor. So I was like, yeah, they stupid at holiday parties, but mostly, like, they're just normal suburban outside of Baltimore humans. It wasn't until my mother, I'm lucky I have a real Shirley MacLaine in terms of endearment mother, you know, like a real my child's ankle is sprained, I will get attention immediately type of vibe. So I was always taken care of. So I didn't really notice it until I had to watch her advocate for other older members of our family. Mm-hmm. And my great-grandmother, who raised my mom, my mom was always about, like, how do we get make sure she has the best healthcare? How do we do this? And I just didn't understand how my mom always went into it so with such suspicion until my great uncle, his aorta burst one day, and we took him to the hospital. And it was scary because he didn't know what was going on, so we picked him up and took him. But my mom freaking out, calling everyone. I'm with my aunt. She's calling other people because they wouldn't believe how serious it was for him. Mm-hmm. That this isn't, you know, this isn't a man. It's a generation of men who do not like going to the hospital, do not like, you know, dealing with medicine because of what they know that have happened to the people ahead of them. And she is fighting for them to treat this man's pain with the severity that ultimately, if it had been 20 minutes later, he wouldn't have lived the silly last years of his life that he got to live. So it wasn't, and there are later things, of course, that, like, came around where I was just like, oh, cool, I'm not going to get listened to at the rate of my friends. But I was introduced to the advocacy for those who need it first, rather than advocating for myself, which I think to this day is still a problem, where I will, like, fight to make sure y'all get what you need to need. And, like, I will have to go pull some Shirley MacLaine in an urgent care on a college campus, which I definitely did in 2009, 2010, but have a harder time doing it for myself.
Mm-hmm. Alyssa, you know, you and I have talked about this over text and just in the last, over the course of the last 3 years, but do you ever feel like the system is sort of designed? Because it's ridiculous that to go to the doctor, you almost have to have an assistant to be like, no, it's real. Do you ever feel like the system is designed to just exhaust you and make you discouraged and then just give up?
Definitely. You know, first of all, just finding a doctor who will accept you and whatever insurance you have is a full-time job. I routinely am on the phone with my insurance and I start every conversation with, I need to warn you, I'm frustrated, but I'm also aware this is not your fault. I mean, like, that's literally, they must have a picture of me up at the Blue Cross headquarters somewhere. But not only that, I had a really terrible experience with a gynecologist when I was pretty young. I was like 22. And she was so mean, like the meanest person I have ever encountered. But the worst was she told me I needed an antibiotic. I was on birth control. Guess what, guys? A lot of antibiotics negate the birth control. And so she didn't tell me. The pharmacist didn't tell me. So then all of a sudden, one of my girlfriends is like, wait a minute. Like, you know, your birth control is probably not working. I call the doctor to see if I now need GASP, the morning after pill, just to be safe. And she gave me like a 5-minute shoutdown about why I was so irresponsible. Now, Alyssa at age 45 now knows I could have really raised hell, but mostly I was so ashamed because she made me feel ashamed. I didn't go to a gyno for 6 years after that.
Wow.
One, the she pronoun of that is always pretty spectacular, but it is like for someone whose focus is women's health. I think it's also part of women are always afraid that, like, we're going to get in trouble more. So, like, going on the defensive when it's like, but your job is my body. Like, you understand that I'm just here because
no one told me this. And I'm trying to be responsible for where I am in my life. But because you fucked up, you're going to freak. Okay, party. Like, that's, I will never understand that. And, like, I don't work in such a high-stakes industry. Mm-hmm. And, like, that needs to be a test. How responsible are you for your actions? Mm-hmm. I don't know.
To the point, though, too, it's like, I was lucky that to Aaron, your question about having an assistant, like I had like 3-4 roommates at the time. And when I went home, I was crying and I was so upset and they were like, fuck that shit. And everybody, we just sat in a circle and we're like, okay, like, what do we have to do? And it's like, you really do need someone to like game plan it out with sometimes. Like, okay, I'm going, what do I need to ask? I haven't been feeling good, but how do I explain my not feeling good so that they don't like brush my symptoms off? Mm-hmm. Like going to the doctor and it's like going to the gyno, especially and being like, I'm so tired around my period. No. You need like a very illustrative, graphic, vivid scenario to explain so that they focus and don't just try to be like, take Advil.
Mm-hmm. I swear. Well,
it's like our bodies communicate in pain, but then we have to communicate that in words to someone who doesn't necessarily understand. Yeah. Right. Somebody who doesn't necessarily empathize extremely with our pain. And it just feels like a real roadblock. Julissa, you looked like you wanted to say something.
Well, I was just going to say that I guess one like lucky thing about being Mexican. Well, there are many lucky things, but one lucky thing about in particular talking about the healthcare system is that I feel like I've had to advocate for myself since I was a little girl, because my parents never wanted to take me to the doctor. So like my first advocacy was just to get my parents to realize that, no, this was not something that we could cure with Vaporú, or, you know, not something that like the curandera could give me some like herbal tea and like go away. Or like the person who like, I forget what they're called, but basically they're like a chiropractor that didn't go to school, right? Like they're just like, squeeze you and like rub you and then like you're all good to go most of the time. But there were several times definitely where I was just like so sick, and I kept telling my mom like, I'm sick, mom, I really am sick. But like they never wanted to take me to the doctor. And so I think that because of that, I've never had a problem showing up to a doctor's office and being like, I don't feel well, and the little pill that you want to give me, like, that's not going to do it. I've had this before. They prescribed me that. It didn't work. So I think I've learned from being very young to not just trust what the doctor says, because I know my body best and I know what I'm feeling. Mm-hmm. And the doctor, yes, they went to school and they're trained. However, they're not in my body. And so if something doesn't feel right, I never have a problem saying this doesn't feel right.
Off of like what Aaron said and Julissa too, of just like our bodies express something being wrong in terms of pain. And then we have to translate that. But when you are like a brown, black woman in this country, they don't love the way we express things that are heightened. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So even in trying to accurately describe your pain, if you do it in the way that feels natural to how fucking upset your body is, you're being dramatic and you're doing too much and you're over, she might be exaggerating. That might be, you know, drug seeking behavior. Or instead, you try to put it in the, you know, customer service interview tone. You can, even if you're clutching a part of your skin, and then they're like, well, you seem okay. Mm-hmm. And there's no way to win there.
Yeah.
And which makes it more difficult for people who haven't had to advocate for themselves for as long as you have, and as well as you have, to like, then they get like, especially I do, I get in my brain of like, well, if I tell this man what I think of him, will I get what I need?
Right.
And I know I won't. So I will sit there quietly and wait until he gives me the exact medicine I told him I already had when I got here. And then I have to get into a fight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was. I want to cite some statistics that back up 100% of what you're saying, Riri. A 2014 survey found that 91% felt that the healthcare system discriminates against female patients. Nearly half of the people who responded to the survey were at one point told that pain was all in their head. It's also super common to have pelvic and menstrual pain, especially if it's caused by things that are difficult to diagnose on first glance, like endometriosis or fibroids or PCOS. A lot of times those women are told that pain is in their head. And Black and brown women get it especially intensely, where they're not believed, they're prescribed less pain medication. And they report less effective pain management than white patients. So there is like a systemic problem with this. And also I want to say the advocacy thing, just reading from all the hundreds of email submissions we got, a few of them came from doctors. Doctors who were like, hey, I'm a doctor. And when I go to the doctor, I have to be like, listen to me. And if it's this hard for me, then I can't imagine how hard it is for people who have a language barrier or who are less educated, or, you know, there's so many ways that it could be harder for everybody else. I think going to the OBGYN is a particularly fraught experience. And a lot of what I've noticed in the submissions from our listeners was that people tried to get around the uncertainty of how uncomfortable it could be by selecting a female doctor or a male doctor. And just using the anecdata that we have gathered here, it really, you cannot reliably, it seems like we had bad stories from both, because doctors are human beings and there's no way reliably to get around somebody who's not going to do a great job. Alyssa, you and I have talked about this before. Like I see a midwife here in LA who is part of a practice where there's a female doctor. Every single practitioner is a woman. And that's my comfort level. I couldn't imagine ever going to see an OBGYN that's a man, but you feel differently.
I do. All of my doctors are LGBTQ men.
Yes.
I love them. I love them. Shout out to Dr. Bruce Bond, who I know listens to us, and Dr. Goldberg. Because there is something that I have found, and it is, I lucked out. I met Bruce Bond 6 years after my horrific experience. I gave him a chance. I traveled from New York to see him, from Boston to see him, because he was in DC. When I would move around, Chicago to see him. Because once I found someone, I'd pay out of pocket to see him, because it was such a joy and he listened to me. Like, I have all sorts of gastro issues. Everybody knows because I wrote about it in my book. And you need someone who is just not telling you to drink more fucking water. Do you know how many times people tell me to just drink more water? And Dr. Bond, he got me through, like, whether to have kids, whether I could have kids. And Dr. Goldberg has really solved my stomach issues. But Doc Goldberg is a special case, because I met him after I went to four emergency rooms. And every one of them told me it was in my head. The debilitating pain in my gut was in my head. They're like, well, you don't have the flu. I was like, I don't think I have the flu. I think it's far worse than the flu. And then I meet this man. A friend of mine was like, go see him. He listens. That was what she said. He listens. He asked me 90 questions.
Wow.
And when he got to the last one, he's like, okay, so do you drink? I was like, yes. He's like, does it make your stomach hurt more? I was like, no, it makes it feel better. He's like, that is impossible. And I was like, no, it's true. And then he's like, oh, I get it. I get it. And he has managed to take care of this entire biome for years because he listened. I was there yesterday to see him. My first time I wanted to hug him, I was like, you're the one person I really want to hug right now. But he, for me, it is, he listened. And because my problem, my pain was actually, which most people would have totally just disregarded, my pain was actually coming from severe crippling anxiety in my brain. And I couldn't control it. And I was really, really sick from it. And guess what? I'm not even on Wellbutrin anymore. What?
Yeah, but here's the thing. Like, so what if it's in your head? Your head is a part of your body that sometimes needs to be treated.
They don't want to hear that at the ER.
You know what I mean? It's like they still need to, that's the root issue that needs to be addressed.
Erin, baby, you know the title of your podcast, right? It's like the idea that holding pain, holding stress, holding these things that are huge. If we've learned, one of the few things I hope we have learned this year is the strength of the mental strain on your body. That it can knot you up and destroy you. But it's decided that is a utterly
flimsy excuse to be in excruciating pain. And that's so frustrating because we look at like how that affects the way you go about your life, the way it affects all different parts of your body, the way you, your reproductive system, your, the way you care for your children, which then affects their healthcare and the people, other people in your life. It's just so frustrating that we're still always getting back to like why mental health is minimized and why isn't it treated like the health crisis that it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, Alisa, you said something about like he listened, your doctor listened. Mm-hmm. And it just reminded me of I also had a lot of stomach problems before. And Dr. Kummer in New York, he like literally saved me. And I had also seen like so many other doctors. And he just really was very thorough, right? It was like colonoscopy, endoscopy, like mm-hmm. all the COSPs, whatever they're called, like everything. And then finally figured out like, you know, what was going on with me. But I remember one particular time when I went to see him, and it had been the week that one of my best friends like tragically passed away, and I could not get through the appointment. Like I just started sobbing. I was like shaking. And so he asked me, you know, what's going on? So I told him what happened, and I told him how I was feeling about it. And, you know, he was my stomach doctor, and he still prescribed me a very small dose for a week of some anxiety medicine. I forget which one. And because he did that, like I was actually able to go to the memorial, because I really don't think that I would have made it, or I would have had to been removed from the memorial, because I was just not in a right mental and physical state. And it's because he listened. You know, he could have just like, he could have just been very nervous about a woman in his office hysterically crying, which has happened, you know, like somebody sees you crying, they're just like, I'll give you a moment and like walk out, right? And he didn't do that. Like he asked questions, and even though he wasn't, you know, he was my stomach doctor, he realized that there was something else going on with me that day and listened and took care of it. And I don't see Dr. Kummer anymore because I don't live in New York City anymore. But truly, he is like a great doctor and a great human being. Mm-hmm.
I would think the relief of finding a person who can treat what seemed like an untreatable thing before is such a relief whenever you get around to it. We got so many stories from people who basically people had to go to 5 or 6 doctors to find out that they had endometriosis. 5 or 6 doctors, especially chronic health conditions or something, that it took them doctor after doctor. Like one woman wrote us and she has lupus. Her dad has lupus, but it took her like 5 doctors to make that connection. Oh, maybe this person also has the chronic condition that runs in her family. It seems like there's a pattern among it within the system, first of all, where it's like, if you have a problem that a doctor can't figure out, the doctor is like, well, then you're crazy. I can't figure it out. Ergo, you're crazy. And it's like, no, you're just not the one to figure this out. And that just seems to be something that happens a lot with like chronic conditions and pain stuff. One thing I wanted to also add is like all this doctor shopping in the US gets expensive. Yeah. Because you have to pay for that visit, whether or not the doctor just came into the room and, you know, blew a party streamer and then like walked out. You have to still pay for that. Do you think we should have to pay for times that doctors get it wrong? Shouldn't we get that for free?
I don't.
Wouldn't that be nice?
I mean, it would be lovely. It's hard because it's like I want to respect their work. Like if I were to believe that everyone is coming from a place of good, maybe theoretically, hypothetically, then I don't think that they're trying to like fuck us. I think they also have like how many people they're going to treat that day and what they've decided their time is worth and like all of that big stuff. But it is like the access to the people that might be able to help you more being so expensive. Like I very freely now that, or last couple of years of living in LA when I was just an assistant and just like really hustling, but I had like very fancy white ladies getting me into very nice doctor's offices. And the first time I got sent to one that figured something out that really helped me, that like really, we really got closer to something. And I was like, this costs who? this is on a plan. This will be on a plan. Was so shocking.
because that was like to get in one trip the like the consultation, the ultrasound, to get really like movement on what I needed to check out, and then realize, oh, to have healthcare this good for me and where I am today is going to cost me a couple trips not to brunch. Got it.
Yeah, I think one thing, you know, in addition to the cost barrier, I think sometimes, I don't know a single woman that doesn't have an experience like this, or a single person with a uterus who doesn't have an experience like this, where you go to the doctor and the doctor makes wildly inappropriate assumptions about your sexuality or about your desire to have children or not have children. Have you ever felt judged going to a doctor about something womanly, a decision you're making or not making? Alyssa?
I actually, because aforementioned Dr. Bruce Bond retired, I had to get a new gyno. And I went to her a couple months ago, and she was like, okay, so you're 44, you're going to be 45. How many kids do you have? I don't have any kids. Oh, I was like, oh, my legs are in stirrups. You're going to owe me? Like, it was just so much. And then you guys, like, as I have explained, I think that, I mean, you all know me. I became a stuttering fucking fool. I sit up. I'm like, well, so here's the thing. And I go through the whole story as if to justify myself, when really, like, just fucking give me my pap smear at this point. But then after I did all that, I was so nervous. I was so nervous. You guys, I was so nervous that I literally tensed up such that the pap smear was excruciatingly painful. And she literally said at this point, there's no anatomical reason you should be in this much pain, and told me to drink water.
What? No.
All of that is entirely true. And I just was like, Alyssa, I was getting dressed when it was all over. And I was like, this is an aberration. Okay. You're not going to not go to the doctor for 6 more years because of this. Like, you're fine. And it was awful. But just the fact that she was like, how many kids do you have? Oh, like, should I go die now? Like, was that the, oh, you were implying? Mm-hmm. But that was it. And it was so, such a small room. I was hot. My face was like on fire red. It was terrible.
Ugh. I'm getting like empathetic claustrophobia just thinking about
that.
Yeah, that
was bad.
I think I felt that a little bit of that pain. I was like, oh, I know what that feels like because I have been there. I'm like, oh no.
It's like a tiny little wince. It's like my cervix like, oh.
I yelped and I go, hurry up.
No, thank you.
Riri, have you ever had like assumptions made about you in that sort of a context, or have you ever had a friend that had that happen to?
Yeah. I mean, I guess people tell me I'm 31 now. So it is, and I love information. I love research. So I have started to every year be like, okay, so if I were to do this alone, like have kids alone because I want to have kids, like what's the plan there? And I am someone, because I have changed insurance almost every other year for the last couple of years, have had different doctors. And so it is, I get a little of like, oh, you want to, not judgment, but like, oh, you're thinking of doing this by yourself. It's like, yeah, like, welcome to Los Angeles in your 30s. Like, baby, this is what it is. But the thing that has been more judgy my entire life is the fat thing. Because I've been called fat since I was 13. And it's like, nah, honey, these are titties. Welcome. But it is like every doctor ever is like, you should really think about changing your diet and your exercise regime. And it's like, I'm a bigger girl, but I'm not a big, big girl, and with no shade to that. But it's like the fact that it always comes into like, this is affecting your health, when all of my tests are fine, my blood pressure is fine, except for like the one time I had a very tense call with my lawyer right before going into an appointment. They told me that I was told to sit down and we would take my blood pressure in 20 minutes. But other than that, I have pretty normal stats. And for them to say, well, you should really look at like how this is affecting your health, because my BMI isn't what they would like it to be, because that's just shittily living. You can be healthy and you can be bigger. And like, that's what's always been really frustrating, because I had such shame around it. Because I have a smaller, most of the people in my family are on the smaller side. And so it's like, then what am I doing wrong? And how you hold that with you, even when you're older, when you have things like, my eyes are shaped funky and I have to have special contacts and like something, and my eye hurt one day. I was like, well, I did it wrong. I'm the one who fucked this up. It's like, no, you gave me the wrong lenses. But like, there are these that gets ingrained in you that your health is your fault, mm-hmm. which I think is so destructive. Because, yeah, there are some things you can take control of and take the reins up. And there are certain things that sometimes you let the reins go because it's a little too rocky for you. But that's really frustrating. I think that would be like the one thing I wish that we could find a way to move through of, like, without using, you know, well, the, you know, these people, they don't like to do that. It's like, the bitch, who you say is these people? Mm-hmm. You know, anthropology enthusiasts? Let's go. It's very frustrating. You know,
Riri, we got a lot of messages from people who had the same feeling of going to the doctor and feeling like dehumanized to the point that like doctors wouldn't even think to look for problems that weren't directly related to their weight. So there was a woman who wrote us who had recovered from thyroid cancer. Well, what does your thyroid do? It makes it so it's very, it regulates your weight among other things. And mm-hmm. so after she had thyroid cancer, it was hard for her to regulate her weight, and they wouldn't even look for problems beyond the weight when she went into the doctor. And it's just like, it sounds like a huge barrier in the American healthcare system, the fact that we don't see people as human beings.
Yeah. Also, it goes back to what Alyssa was saying about listening. You know, like I have crickety joints, crickety. Okay. Like walked in a Birkenstock half up a hill, sprained my ankle, was down for 2 weeks. Honey, this is elite cricketiness. But it's not from the fact that, you know, I'm a size 16. It's from the fact that I became this tall too quickly when I was 13, 14 years old. And if you were to listen to me when I say, yeah, my bones grew too fast for my tendons, and so I've always been left in like a more precarious situation, then we could work towards it. And like, yes, I've like tried to go to physical therapy or whatever. But back a couple of years ago when I was really like, I'm kind of done with this being shit, they were like, well, have you thought about losing weight? I was like, you know, I have. I instead lean into a carbonara, but that's my journey. But mostly, like, why aren't we talking about, like, should I have a referral to an orthopedist? Should I be looking at the, like, what supplements do I need to be taking? What, like, injections of steroids should I might be taking to make my life better, not to shame me for being who I am? Mm-hmm.
Riri, true story. My mom was blown away and disturbed that I could remember the outfit I was wearing when my doctor told me when I was 4 years old that I should lay off the Twinkies, because I wasn't eating Twinkies. I was the healthiest eater you could imagine. And she's like, Alyssa, it's impossible you remember that. I was like, I remember it like yesterday. I still recall it, and it makes my face hot.
I remember putting my uniform back on and not looking at my doctor while she was telling me that I was too heavy. And it sticks with you. And it just like, and it's so frustrating, because it's like, I see so many people who are so fantastic, but they just want their healthcare providers to like provide them with healthcare. Mm-hmm. And because we hate fat people in this country and on this globe, they refuse to do that. And that's just so fucked up.
The thing about living, like, I live in Los Angeles, the air is bad. When I go to the doctor and I'm having trouble breathing, the doctor isn't like, why don't you try not living in Los Angeles? It's like, no, I live in Los Angeles, and so we're going to treat you where you are.
I had a story about I have two stories, but one was about the, like, being a woman and like what doctors have told us, right?
Sure.
So I used to have really amazing healthcare, and I've said this on this pod before about how amazing of healthcare I had when I worked in finance. And one of the benefits of that healthcare was that they would freeze your eggs. Like, if you wanted to, it was part of the health coverage that would freeze your eggs for you. And I cannot tell you how many times I was asked, do I want to freeze my eggs? Like, every visit, do you want to freeze your eggs? And I didn't want to freeze my eggs because I didn't know if I wanted to have kids, Like, I had no idea if I wanted to have kids or not. But it was really annoying that the assumption was that because I am a woman and I don't have a partner at that time, that I might want to freeze my eggs. You know, mm-hmm. just make a note. She does not want to freeze her eggs. So that next time they don't ask me that question again. Because it's like, I don't know. It's a great benefit.
That's a painful procedure. Like, I know women who have frozen their eggs. I know women who have had IVF. And that is not just a thing that you're like, okay.
You don't just go to the bathroom and poop them out. Like, that's not how it works.
Oh, you know? Don't? Like, okay.
Yeah. And then the other thing I was going to say about the losing weight thing, I mean, I have always been like a little thicker, had a little bit more to grab onto. It's just always been my body.
The best and, people do. Well,
except, you know, except that one year when I lost a ton of weight because I was heartbroken. But I gained it right back. So thank you for that. But every doctor I go to, like whether it was my back doctor or like my stomach doctor, like every doctor I have my whole life heard, you should lose 10 pounds. Like 10 pounds somehow is like the magic number. They even decided, if I weigh 20 yeah. pounds more, you know, like I weighed 10 more pounds at the last time you told me I needed to lose 10 pounds, but you still telling me to lose 10 pounds. Like 10 pounds is like the magic number. Except nobody tells you how to do it. Nobody says, you know, and I do like diabetes runs in my family. So watching my weight is something that is important to my health, my specific health, right? But nobody ever says, you need to lose 10 pounds and like here is a program for how to do it. You know, here is I don't know, a nutritionist you can go see. Like mm-hmm. it's always just go lose 10 pounds. Like I could snap a finger and lose 10 pounds just by snapping my finger. Like losing weight is hard. It's really hard to lose weight and it's really hard to keep the weight off once you've lost it. It just is. And so I wish that for those of us who do actually have to watch our weight because there are illnesses that run in our families, that then there was some education on how to do it and that education and those programs were then also covered by insurance. Mm-hmm. If I could have a great nutritionist that is part of my insurance plan, why, you know, I would love to go see a nutritionist and have them give me a meal plan of what I should eat every single day. That would be amazing. But mm-hmm. guess what? Losing weight is part of what the doctors tell you, but the how to do it isn't actually part of the spectrum of healthcare, and that's mm-hmm. a problem.
Right. You know, it's interesting. Like when I've gone to the one thing that I've noticed is that's a huge. It's never been catastrophic for me, but it's been something that's always been like, why is it like this? But whenever I've gone to the gynecologist, the assumption has been that everyone is there who is there, A, wants to have kids, and B, doesn't have any problems doing it, quote unquote, naturally. And so one time, here's an example. I was living in Chicago and I was in a bad relationship, a relationship that was so bad that I was like stressed out and having a hard time eating enough, and I was underweight. And I went to the OBGYN and they weighed me and told me I was underweight. And the OBGYN was this Ukrainian lady. And she's like, you have to gain 10 pounds. Otherwise, no babies. And she like, I was underweight because I was terrified of my boyfriend. Like, she didn't even ask me, like, why are you, you know, like, why are you like this? Is this how much you normally weigh? Like, is something on your mind? Is something going on in your life? It was just like, better gain weight, otherwise no babies. Also, like, gaining weight enough to have babies with that guy would have been a fucking disaster. Holy shit. No way. And, you know, it was just like a minor thing, but I was just, it stuck with me, you know? It was like, you didn't even care to ask why or try to figure out why I was too small. You know,
and you like, literally could have had cancer. Like there are so many reasons you could be underweight.
Yeah. There's like, you know, besides just like environmental factors, there could be something very wrong in your body. I could have had a tapeworm. I could have had a real bad tapeworm that was eating all my food. It was like you assume that I want to have children. And, you know, when I went to get my IUD removed at the OBGYN and, you know, a couple months ago, and I when I looked around in the lobby and, you know, I thought about, I've had so many friends, you know, I'm in my late 30s or mid to late 30s, at 37, mid, late, I'll call it mid 30s.
Own it. Own the mid.
So I, you know, I have a lot of friends that are my age that have had completely different journeys in fertility. Some of them have had no problem getting pregnant and having children and not miscarrying. Other people have had just a really, really hard time, like a heartbreaking relationship testing journey to getting pregnant. And, you know, the lobby of every OBGYN I've ever gone to has been like pictures of smiling babies. And, you know, that's really great. And like, if you're a person that's, you know, that's pregnant and stuff, that seems like on theme. But thinking about my friends that have had problems with infertility, man, that sucks. That sucks to just like every time you go to the doctor and have to deal with the problem that you're facing, to just see pictures of something that seems like it's so easy for everybody else, and to just always be treated like, you know, you're doing something wrong. And one of our listeners who wrote in was, you know, she was talking about how expensive going through like all these infertility treatments was. And she was like, you know, it's crazy. Insurance covers almost every body part that doesn't work, except not when your reproductive system doesn't work. So like, what the fuck? You know, it's really an upsetting situation. And I think that just because it's the OBGYN and because you're taking your pants off and you're letting somebody poke around up inside of you, it just is, it's like more sensitive a place than any other doctor's visit, you know? And I think the fact that we all have like, ugh, kind of stories about it is a testament to the fact that things need to get better. Let's talk about what needs to change in the healthcare system. What do you think the biggest thing that needs to change in order to assure that people have better health outcomes in the system? Alyssa, you're the policy wonk. What do you think needs to change?
Accessibility, Erin. Accessibility needs to change. If we all had the same healthcare, we'd all be able to see the doctors we want to see and not feel like when you think about it, if like Riri, you were saying, same with me, my healthcare has changed a bunch over the past couple of years. You finally find a doctor you like, there is like no greater, I take that back. There are many greater senses, but there is such a sense of being a victim when you're like, I found something I like and I can't have it. Like, it's just like, why can't I keep going to that doctor? So, Erin, I would say accessibility, and everyone should have healthcare, because we all know that the more that we are able to do preventative things, the less dire things happen. So there is my very insightful answer. Mm-hmm.
Julissa, how about you? What do you think needs to change first?
I think accessibility, it all really comes down to that. I really think that everybody should have like Goldman Sachs level health insurance, because my best experiences with doctors were when I could just call any doctor. I could go to out-of-network doctors because my insurance covered 80% of out-of-network doctors. So I could go see any doctor I wanted anytime for any reason. And everybody should have access to that. There's no reason why only a few people have access to that healthcare and then the rest of us are having to spend, you know, an hour on the phone just to get an appointment. Or, you know, I go to a physical therapist that's not even part of my insurance because it's only $10 more than my copay and I can get an appointment the same day versus going through my insurance, having to wait a couple of weeks to get an appointment. And so if everybody just had excellent healthcare, then I think that doctors would also be in a better position, because doctors also have to make a living, right? They, a lot of doctors don't, the best doctors don't have to deal with insurance. They can go be out-of-network doctors with people that just pay them in cash, right? And so if doctors were also compensated in a different way, not through health insurance, not where they have to, you know, there's also a lot of paperwork, and sometimes we don't really recognize how much shit and paperwork doctors and doctors' offices have to deal with to get paid by an insurance, to get paid by Medicare, to get paid by Medicaid. And so if we just simplify the system, not just for the patients, but also for the doctors and for the nurses and the dentist, then I think everybody would be much happier and we would get much better service from the doctors because they would be in a better mood.
Riri, what do you think needs to change?
I think Meghan McKay needs to know how to get her vaccine and when it's going to happen.
If we're talking about accessibility, I think we need to talk about the issue on the table. I mean, yeah, the thing is accessibility and rhetoric around going to the doctor, I think, needs to change, or and acknowledging that there is some fear. There is some, like, you know, institutional memory fear that people have towards it. You know, I'm thinking about everyone loves to slam, like, Black and brown people right now, like they're not getting the vaccine. But then you see that convention center in Philly with thousands of people outside waiting to walk up to hopefully get, you know, so even the way we talk about it, the way it's covered, I think if we could figure out how to get rid of referrals just generally, I think that would be really cute. And if we could find a way to make the job of, like, healthcare advocate architect profitable for them and then so helpful for everyone else, I think that would be a really great step, because every one person on here has talked about having to talk to their insurance, having to figure out what the next move is, having to caucus with your girlfriends because some bitch won't give you plan B. Like, how do you, if there were people who help, were literal shepherds to help us through this in a way that you don't feel like it's going to be Rosamund Pike putting your grandma in a retirement home. I think that would be really, I think that'd be really wonderful. And I think it, when we look at, like, how we're going to come out of all of this with so many people with pre-existing conditions based off of a pandemic that they could not control or were subject to, I think we're going to really need that space and those advocates. Mm-hmm.
So I think mine are kind of trolly. I think we just need to get rid of the insurance industry entirely. It serves no purpose. It doesn't provide any care, and all it does is exist to generate profit. It is useless and it harms people and it's bad and it needs to go away. And I realize I've gone full Bernie here, but I've gone full Bernie here. Second thing is, if we can't do that, then I think people, I don't even know if this would work. This might be a stupid idea. We should pass resolutions, like, by public referendum that guarantee people the same level of healthcare as elected officials. So, like, we pass, like, a Prop 22, but not shitty, in California, that's like, everybody, you know, people who are on public aid are guaranteed the same level of healthcare as elected officials. I feel like that would be a great way to really make people start paying attention to the urgency of this problem. If we made congressmen go to the same doctors that, like, people who are on the lowest rungs of American society have to go to, I think it'd get fixed really quick.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's why I'm not running for president. Okay. Let's take a quick break. This was a great conversation. And thank you, listeners, everyone who sent us something. It really helped shape the way that this discussion went. And we really appreciate all of you for reaching out. And I'm sure this is something we'll be able to talk about again, because there are things we didn't even get to dip the surface of, LGBTQAI issues when it comes to going to the doctor. We didn't get to really talk about the childbirth experience because none of us have given birth. But we can, you know, we'll talk about these things in future shows. So if you have thoughts, please weigh in. Let's take a quick break. But when we come back, I feel petty.
The country feels like it's falling apart right before our eyes, and the people inside it are being silenced.
So we're going to East 26th Street and Nicollet Avenue, which is where Alex Preti was executed by ICE and Border Patrol.
That is not a headline. That is a human life. And it is all happening right now.
Do you worry about your own safety being involved in all this?
Yes, but it doesn't really feel like there's another option, you know?
And of course they use a five-year-old child as bait. And of course they're doing all these horrible, bad things because they don't know what they're doing. They've been told that they're going to get rid of the worst, then they have absolute immunity. And they've been told that nothing they do will they ever be held accountable for.
On my show, Runaway Country, we go where the headlines hit home, from communities under threat to the people fighting to be heard. New episodes of Runaway Country drop every Thursday. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or watch on YouTube.
Welcome back. We've reached the part of the show where we take really strong stances on things that don't really matter very much. It's I Feel Petty. All right. Who feels pettiest this week? Who wants to go first? Riri, you said you had a serious one.
Yeah, mine's a little more serious this week. I feel pretty petty about the fact that folk aren't going out of their way to post about issues on social media until they're already pre-made like meme infographics. So like the rise of like attacks on like Asian American communities has gone obscene in the last year. It's been a couple stories, and it really did feel for a moment like unless you had folk of the community in your life, weren't really hearing about it until about 2 or 3 weeks ago, when there was a big push on Twitter. Like, look at these local articles, but unless you're on Asian American Twitter, you're not really seeing it. So that, like, there was a couple days where you started seeing people posting articles and like, please look at this, please, these GoFundMes, please find out who this fucking guy in Queens is who pushed someone's mom down and she busted her head open. Like, let's help out. But then it was like a 3-day period until then the pretty like salmon colored ones with a border were up, and like the ones that had more, you know, like someone did a digital graphic or something, and it blew up. And part of that is maybe that more people were seeing it. But I also think part of it is that some people just didn't like, it didn't fit their brands for their like posting to do it, to just take a screenshot of like a Chronicle piece. And that's and it just feeds into like my bigger, not anger, but feelings around like what was happening this summer and what's happened since, of like, unless an issue or unless a moment of outrage is like bottled up in a way that like really works on a story, it really works on a repost, it feels like it's still just the folk who are being affected by it talking about it. Mm-hmm. And it takes longer to jump over into the discourse. I think the lighter one is, y'all, your Instagram ain't your real life, look like you give a fuck about something. But in this specific case, I was watching, and I was late on the uptick of realizing like how bad it had been, because it wasn't until all my Asian friends were telling me about it that I realized like I'm missing this because it's just not getting to my sphere. And I felt bad about it. But then like in sitting in that for 2 weeks, I was like, oh, this is the cycle of it. Mm-hmm. And how did we get folk to feel like it's their job to not just like raise awareness, but actually like speak on it, think on it, like look at how you interact with it. Mm-hmm. If it's not bottled or like marketed in a way that like feels not too dark to have on their brand.
I mean, I think on another level, this is like that you're right. It is an annoying behavior for people to just wait for it to fit their aesthetic before they take a stand on something. I think it's also like another symptom of like the death of local news. The fact that these things aren't being funneled immediately up to, you know, funneled and covered in depth at the local level and then grabbed and elevated to the national level. I mean, a lot of it's happening in major cities, so that's why we even know about what we know about it. But it seems like it must be happening in places outside of San Francisco and Queens.
Yeah.
You know, and we're just maybe not hearing about it because local news is dying or being bought up by private equity, and all we can do now is post about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think part of it is it sometimes can feel so impotent because, like, what else can you do? And so why wouldn't you just be like, okay, it doesn't look like everything else you're posting with your matcha and all of the other stuff. I don't know. I want people to say things with their chest, and there's something about waiting for it to be formatted that like is frustrating to me.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. That's like, it is a serious one, but I can also see the pettiness there.
Thank you. Oh, she's complaining on the podcast she's on about Insta stories. Okay.
Alyssa, do you want to go now?
Oh yeah. Mine is so, mine is stupid.
Yeah.
Okay. So like Newsmax and OANN and all of these things, they have like nothing left to talk about. So they were attacking Joe Biden's dogs. Why would you do that? Why would you say they're dirty? It's so wrong. It's so mean. They are rescue dogs. They gave these animals a home. They're wonderful. And like, could you imagine just being the person that had to read that copy that was just like, and today we see these filthy dogs in the White House. Anyway, it's been on my mind for many days, and is I just that, really couldn't.
Is that like
that's all they have to talk about?
Strategy? I mean, but like coming out against dogs is not really a winning strategy when it comes to popular opinion.
Literally. And like, I think the same day that, you know, part of that plane going from Denver to Hawaii, like part of it fell into someone's yard. It's like, cover that, you assholes. Like, do something else.
I'm very mad I found that out like 2 days later. Like, I feel like United flights just dropping bits. Was it big? No. No, we need to prioritize what gets to the people.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's anti-dog stance questionable for sure. I will go next because mine's really stupid. And I think it really echoes a lot of what old people are saying. What the fuck is Clubhouse? What is it? I can't use it. I don't like it. It's podcasts, but worse.
It's the radio. Alyssa, yes. When you joined, got a notification and then it goes, do you want to welcome Alyssa? Then it sent me into a live room where I didn't realize I was waiting for you to join. I was like, oh no, she has shit to do. And so then I had to like jump out of it.
It was so scary. I was like, someone invited me. It was like very nice of them. And I got on there. Literal social anxiety from just being alone in my room. It's too much. It makes no sense. The question is why? Don't you feel like it's a little bit like people are like just trying to be popular? I mean, I know it's this point of all social media, but it's like, join me in my clubhouse. It's like, no, it's where bad things happen.
It's like live podcasting.
Yeah.
It's a live show.
Without the quality check.
But you can't save the conversations, right? Like you can only listen to them live. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I did my first clubhouse this weekend. And we were actually talking about Asian American hate crimes against Asian Americans. So it was like, I thought it was like a very good one. But I was so nervous. Like I was like sweating. I was so nervous because I didn't know when to like stop talking. I didn't know how long I should talk. There's no way people were tweeting at me because they couldn't actually message me through Clubhouse. You know, like we're doing an Instagram live or something. It was very nerve-wracking, and I don't know if I will ever have my own clubhouse conversation. Yeah,
I don't want to be a part. I don't want to be a leader. I don't want to be a part of this. But I do remember a couple weeks ago when I only heard about it from Black Twitter, and they were having Dream Girls like sing-offs in front of people who had been in Dream Girls. So like Cheryl Lee Ralph was in there being like, "Baby, no."
Oh
like so, I saw something. Apparently, some girl sang one note, and they were like, "You can stop." And I was like, ha, "This is hilarious." But I don't know who needs this. So other than me,
apparently, a lot of people do. It's like the hot new thing.
It's yeah, so I don't get it.
They open it up to everybody, it's not going to be the hot thing.
No, I mean, we're talking on some beta shit right now.
Okay, Jaleesa, do you want to bring us home?
Yes, and I misunderstood the assignment.
Love that. Love that energy. Own it.
So mine is actually serious, but it is also petty, I think. Okay, so this is what I'm feeling very petty about celebrities, about Instagram famous people, about the media, about pretty much everyone. I'm feeling petty about everyone who is not outraged about the new migrant children facility that is going up in Florida, because kids in cages are kids in cages, whether it was under Trump or whether it was under Obama or whether it is now under Biden and Harris. And I find it very disingenuous that people are trying to find the right angle of how to be outraged about this, how to say the right thing about it, how to not anger people that they know in the administration. As far as my angle is that no kids should be in cages ever, ever, ever. And for people that are out there being like, we need to be patient, I'm sorry, but if it was your kid in one of those tents, you would not want to be patient about it. You would want that kid to be out of that tent yesterday. And so if you were outraged and raising hell when kids were in cages during the Trump administration, if you were concerned last week about the migrants in detention centers in Texas because it was freezing, then you need to be outraged and you need to be concerned about what is happening right now today under a Democratic Biden-Harris administration, because this is not the shit we elected you for.
Yeah.
So fix that shit. And for people that are like, this is going to take time, fucking figure it out. What the right answer is, how we need to get rid of those facilities. What the right answer is, I don't know what that right answer is or what that process is, because I am not in government, but they need to figure this shit out. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And Julissa, that was a perfect I feel petty. Is there a resource or like organization that's doing on the ground work advocating for these to be closed if people want to keep up to tabs?
Yes. So Families Belong Together is one organization that is, they have a petition and they're mobilizing. There's, of course, Raices Texas, who I think a lot of people are familiar with, and they are providing legal services to these, and these are unaccompanied minors. So I do want to make it clear, like, what's happening. This isn't babies being ripped apart from their families and then being put in separate cages, right? These are unaccompanied minors. So minors that came to the U.S. without a parent, without a guardian, that's who is being put in jails, who is being put in this cages. They're ages 13 through 17. But those two organizations are, one, doing advocacy work to stop, to have this detention center closed. And Raices Texas is doing legal work to try to get those kids out and into sponsored homes. Mm-hmm. So I would follow those two organizations and call your congressperson, just like we were calling congresspeople before. Like, you can call your congressperson, and we need to put pressure on the administration just like we put pressure on them before.
Mm-hmm. All right. We'll put those links in show notes. We'll also put links to information on the attacks against older Asian Americans. We're not going to link to stuff about Clubhouse because I don't think anybody should join. And I think we all know enough about the Biden's dogs to make a judgment that they're not dirty. Thank you all for joining me. This was a great episode. I'm so glad that it was you ladies who got to have this conversation. Riri, thank you. Julissa, thank you. My ride or die, Alyssa Mastromonaco. And thank you to Dr. Heather Irabunda. And thank you to all of the listeners. Thank you to everybody who sent us stories. And thanks for tuning in every week. There will be more hysteria for you next week. Hysteria is a Crooked Media production. Caroline Rustin is our producer. Our executive producer is me, Erin Ryan. Alyssa Mastromonaco is our co-producer, and Brian Semmel is our associate producer. Kyle Seglin is our sound engineer, and our editor is Sarah Gibbel-Laska and the folks at Chapter 4. Our digital team is Nar Melkonian and Magic Groove. Thank you to Juliet Beckstrand for production support every week.
The country feels like it's falling apart right before our eyes, and the people inside it are being silenced.
So we're going to East 26th Street and Nicolette Avenue, which is where Alex Preti was executed by ICE and Border Patrol.
That is not a headline. That is a human life, and it is all happening right now.
Do you worry about your own safety being involved in all this?
Yes, but it doesn't really feel like there's another option, you know?
And of course they use a five-year-old child as bait. And of course they're doing all these horrible, bad things because they don't know what they're doing. They've been told that they're going to get rid of the worst, then they have absolute immunity. And they've been told that nothing they do will they ever be held accountable for.
On my show, Runaway Country, we go where the headlines hit home, from communities under threat to the people fighting to be heard. New episodes of Runaway Country drop every Thursday. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or watch on YouTube.